This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Benvenuti to the Imperfect Buddha Podcast, the podcast that dares to think differently. Sponsored by O'Connell Coaching.
Welcome back to the Imperfect Buddha Podcast. Today I am talking with Jundo Cohen about a rather unusual book called Building the Future Buddha. And let's dive straight in and find out who Jundo is. Welcome to the podcast, Jundo. Now, what do we need to know about you before we discuss your work?
You know, when you ask a Zen fellow that loaded question, who are you, you're going to get all kinds of strange answers. I'm going to say the tree in the garden or the sound of one hand clapping. But frankly, I'm just an American guy, former lawyer who's been in Japan for 38 years. And somewhere along the line, I became a Soto Zen Buddhist priest. And there's a lot more to me, I suppose. You can ask my kids and my wife about that. You know, Japanese Buddhist priests, we get married. It's okay here.
Yeah.
And so along the way, I got an interest in Soto Zen. And then I started thinking about, you know, Soto Zen needs a few tweaks here and there. And that's why I wrote the book on the future Buddha. But first, I want to say, Matthew, it is such an honor to be here. I have listened to every episode, I think, without exception. Even the hard ones on non-Buddhism that I really struggled with some of the philosophical points, you really go deep on some things. I've listened since the days of Stuart. It was so nice to see Stuart back a few weeks ago talking about a subject dear to my heart, AI. And I just want to thank you for having this podcast for so many years.
Well, that's very sweet of you, Jundo. I must say, you're probably at the point where you're sick of hearing my voice.
Oh, quite the contrary, Matthew. Quite the contrary. You've accompanied me on many a long drive.
Okay. Well, that's great to know. And I appreciate the kind words, as I imagine Stuart does as well. I'd like to have him back on a bit more often, but he's got his own struggles and strifes. And who knows, maybe we will get him back on. The technology was the key to at least getting him back for that one-off episode. And technology is a key theme in the book that you've written, right? So
that's right.
This is one of the conditions many, many of us find ourselves in, and I imagine that extends to Buddhists in Japan as well, which is, you know, what do we do with Buddhism, right? Do we just go on reproducing whatever we receive from our teachers, or do we perhaps try to do something with it, make it more appropriate to our age or our context? And of course, there are those who would resist such an idea and define it as hubris. So let's talk about that first of all. So obviously, a book is the product of many years of thought and reflection. Let's tie that into your idea that maybe there's something to do with Zen. What were some of the original sources of impetus that drove you towards thinking maybe we need to change something or do something or rethink Zen?
Well, I also believe in an imperfect Buddha, or I should say a perfectly imperfect Buddha, which is one of the reasons I really grabbed onto your program. But we're always trying, and that trying involves our vow to rescue all the sentient beings. And for 2,500 years, we've had certain methods and technologies, all variety of them, and it has helped so many people. It saved my life, I can truly say. It has made all the difference. It has been an endless exploration for me. It's been true for, I think, for you, Matthew, even though you're kind of on the fringes, maybe we should say, right now. but finding your own way, and it's been true for millions of people. But we have yet to rescue all the sentient beings in this world. And I think that with new technologies that are coming in medicine, in biology, there is a chance to expand the repertoire of what Buddhism has as its tools in order to do that. So I began inquiring. I live in a place called the Tsukuba Science City, Japan. It's filled with the space program, five or six supercomputers. It has a particle collider, robot factories. And I started talking to the scientists here and thinking, what could the future of science and technology offer to Buddhism? And you know what? We're very close. And also, I got to tell you, I'm very scared because it's very dangerous. And you know why it's dangerous, Matthew. Why do you think?
You're giving me that as a question.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, apart from some of the things that people may already be aware of, I think there's a sort of fundamental issue, which is that the people doing all this are people like you and I, imperfect people, right? Or if you want to play with that metaphor, imperfect Buddhas. And therefore, I think all of this technology is clearly emerging within the context that's already been created by us, and it will be driven in great part by human ignorance and human desire for power and manipulation and whatnot. That would be my first response.
That's exactly my fear. The technologies that are coming will be misused by the military, by industrialists. They will be used by very powerful people to make more money. It is incumbent on Buddhists and not just Buddhists, other concerned individuals, to now start raising our voices that these new technologies are used in good ways. I have to explain this before I say what my ideas are, because I don't think we can stop this. If I thought we could stop many of these technologies by carrying a sign or writing a letter to a politician, I would say, please do it. But they're coming. We cannot stop them. So the question becomes, what do we do with them? And then in that case, concerned individuals, including Buddhists, must start to think, how can we get them to be used for the good? And in the course of that, how can we get them to be used to further the objectives, the traditional objectives of Buddhism, namely to help the sentient beings?
I hear you. So your book then is a form of clarion call for, well, I don't know, I want to call it activism necessarily, but to raise one's voice and stand up and contribute to what discussion, action, the attempt to become more conscious of these dangers and move our evolutionary curve towards a more sane usage of technology. Would that be it?
That's the first half, and the second half is that if we're going to use these technologies, they might actually be a chance to reform human nature to achieve the objectives that for centuries, no preaching, no philosopher, no diatribe in a newspaper, no moral talk has been able to accomplish the change to human nature, to our greed, to our sometimes violent instincts. Nothing has worked, and thus we find ourselves in this world we are now, a world that continues to have wars, wars that are in some ways worse than ever in history, that sees the ecology declining, where there is still such violence and children suffering in the world. But maybe for the first time, there is actually a way to realize what only the utopian thinkers of the past envisioned. Now, I'm not planning for a utopia. You never can fix this world of samsara. It will never be perfect. But if we adjust a few small points, we can be well on the road to realizing what I think even great Buddhists of the past envisioned for this world. That's my dream.
So you're what, utopian adjacent?
No, utopia is too much because I'm truly not an idealist. But I believe if we make a a modicum of change to human nature, and I pinpoint three areas. If we make a modicum of change, many of this world's problems will be much reduced or even vanish. And I hope later in the conversation we can get into what those changes are. But basically, we need to address, because we are Buddhists, different forms of suffering that people face. Number one is dukkha, in the sense of being a separate self, or shall we say, alienation from the universe. That's one. But also, in purely material terms, poverty, homelessness, the violence we find in society, and man's inhumanity to man. I think on both those fronts, coming technologies of medicine, of understanding the brain, the human mind, and what motivates us, coming technologies will allow us to address much of what ails sentient beings on both those fronts.
That's an interesting perspective. I think that my first reaction to that is to say that the political, economical, and current cultural climate will, in a sense, frame the way this technology ends up being used. So, I think the evident potential of technology to radically transform society for the better is certainly there, but the rest is true too.
I come at it the other way. If you change human nature, it will cause a great reform, if not revolutionary changes in the economy and in society. So I come at it the other way. Of course, the way that our society, especially capitalism, are oriented now, these technologies will be misused because human beings will tend to use it for violent purposes, such as the military, or for greed. But if you go about and change human nature, it will have the opposite effect too, of causing great changes in the society. So I call upon well-meaning researchers and scientists to start thinking about developing these technologies in a way that we can make human beings better. Not better. I'm not talking about some kind of master race theory of the past. Nothing ugly like that. My own ancestors suffered at the hands of Nazi Germany. I'm not advocating anything like that. I'm saying that if we can make people a little nicer on just a few fronts, it will work radical changes in many of the problems of this society, including the greed that we see in the dominant classes that run this place right now.
Yeah, that still sounds quite utopian to me, which is not a criticism, huh? It's just, I mean, talking about human nature being that it is so wed to our evolutionary biology, and the hope of somehow just shifting us a couple of points in one direction or the other seems a big ask. But I assume your book is going to tell us how technology might aid that process, so maybe we should get into that next. How would you see the two somehow complementing each other?
Well, the three areas where I think we have a real chance of changing human nature are the following. And by the way, before I get into it too, let me say the book makes clear nothing needs to be forced on people. I believe there is a way, which I hope we touch on later, that people will voluntarily, of their own desire, their own free choice in the marketplace, even in this world where millions of people refuse vaccines and such that are meant to keep them alive, even in a world like that, I believe there is a way in which people can be persuaded to choose this. Nothing will be forced on anyone. It's nothing like that. But let me mention the three ways I propose. Number one, anger to the extent of rage that leads to violence. Much of the violence we find in society is caused by people who cannot control their anger to a point that it results in physical violence, one person against another. If most people in society do not have that kind of anger issue, that I would think I'm getting so angry that I would do violence to another person. A small, small percentage of the population does fall into anger that would cause them to engage in violence. If anger can be moderated, not removed, we need anger to be human beings. Even the Buddha, I think, even Buddhism tolerates some degree of, shall we say, natural human disquiet. To be a little bit peeved is different from falling into a rage, picking up a rock and using it against our neighbor. If we can treat this now as a medical condition in the future and eliminate the tendency to fall into rage, that will eliminate many of the shall we say, social issues where people, even children, feel unsafe in this world right now. But that's not all. I think we're coming to the point where we can increase human empathy. And it sounds like a dream, but I think it is going to be possible to increase empathy where I would see a stranger and think of them or feel for them much as I feel for my own children or some dear friend or someone in my family. If I walked past, let's say, my mother in the street, homeless, I would not walk past. I would lend a hand. It's my mother, of course, or my child, or a friend. It may become possible to increase human empathy. If we increased human empathy to a degree where people could not emotionally within themselves see a child on the other side of the world hungry this evening, this world would be radically changed. Now, again, you don't have to do an overwhelming change to become so empathetic that people are literally, I like to say, donating their heart and both kidneys while they're alive to help others. That would be too much. A modicum of improvement in the degree of empathy we feel would do radical changes. It would be, how could you have a war, as we're seeing in the Gaza right now or Ukraine, if people saw their enemy truly and felt as if they were shooting their own brother? Now, you know, old books spoke about that, treat others like your brother. But if you, there is a biological reason why I think of someone as a stranger or I think of someone as my friend or brother. This can be changed too. That also would work revolutionary changes in society. And the third issue, moderating desires. Right now, are raised in the jungle, animal bodies know nothing except consume, consume, consume. And the modern economic equivalent is to buy, buy, buy. If we were more quickly satisfied, not with zero, we don't have to all live in rags, but more easily satisfied with less, as Zen folks say, with just enough. Well, what would that do to our need to consume, 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 wrap it all in plastic and toss it in the ocean? First off, also the increased empathy. I don't think I would like to see others suffering in a world of environmental decline. We would just with those three small changes, which I think we are truly on the verge of within the coming century, we could deal with a lot of what ails this world. That is my too simple idea, Matthew.
Okay, great. So, I mean, I find your ideas equal parts terrifying and and very optimistic, and I'll explain why. So, firstly, yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think that it is interesting to consider the current development of technology around us. If we tie that into our understanding of cognitive science and the advances being made there, and the fact that already, right, we are already modifying moods constantly, so this is not some kind of alien procedure you're proposing we adopt, right, in order to turn people into passive subjects, right?
It's funny, people who have said, who got upset with my ideas almost say, oh, I don't believe you want to give us substances to change our brains and our heart. Oh, it's terrible, terrible. One second, I got to go take my antidepressant. And the other guy, oh, I gotta go get a beer. He's standing there with a beer, lecturing me about not taking mind-changing substances. Or let's go to the dispensary and get some pot. Let's get some Ozempic to moderate our desires so I can lose 20 pounds. You know, we are flooding ourselves right now with so many chemicals, some of them so bad for us. And what I'm saying is, I believe that using the best medically tested clinical methods we have to find safe ways, good ways, it will be possible in the coming century to go beyond what we're doing now to truly help people be more peaceful, more loving, more moderate in their desires, more empathetic towards others. That's all I'm saying.
The other piece of that, though, is because we do live in a complex world with complex forces all sort of operating both in alignment with each other and disalignment. And, the world is full, obviously, of antagonistic relationships between countries and organizations. I think, again, we're going to get the whole lot. I don't deny that what you're saying is possible. I think we'll get all of that. Yeah, I mean, drinking coffee, just to build on your examples before, drinking coffee is a mood changer and affects the brain. And obviously, a lot of the conversation we have about the brain within cognitive science and especially meditation circles is kind of simplistic and often used for quite specific purposes, which tend to dumb down some of the complexity of that discourse. I don't deny that you might be onto something, and I don't deny that it won't be an option. I wonder if it will be some kind of application that directly affects the brain by triggering certain neural networks or activating certain zones of the brain and softening or subduing or dumbing down others. But just one other thing to that too, which is that I think the one thing that does concern me about any of these kinds of attempts of social engineering is that you're always working from premises, right, which are imperfect too. So that's why I think if we get the whole lot, it's almost better that way. But also this idea that human beings and their animal selves are just consuming creatures, I think, is also inaccurate too. And I wonder to what degree our humanity gets lost in this kind of process, because propositive emotions are great, but if you hang out on them all the time, I think they can also be problematic. So that's just a consideration. That's not an argument against what you're saying. It's just saying I think it's a bit more complicated.
Oh, it's very complicated. Let me try to address some of those concerns very quickly. First off, what are the technologies? This is not clear at the present because we are just at the outset of these technologies being developed on many fronts. Some of them involve genetics, of course, some of them involve neurology. And I am neither a geneticist nor a neurologist. I just speak to people who say that there will likely be in the coming decades amazing possibilities for changing human desire, changing human emotions on one of many fronts. It could involve, for example, something as simple as just a tea we drink that makes us more peaceful and loving. Something as simple as that. It is impossible to tell. I'm just saying that these substances, these methods are coming. Now, are we going to eliminate all human emotions? No. Actually, I think we're going to find ourselves in this case very much as we are now. I'm talking about eliminating just the extremes, the extreme anger, when you fall into a rage to the point of doing violence, increasing somewhat our human empathy towards strangers. Not so much that I'm going to necessarily sacrifice my own life for others, but that I see others who are hungry, and I will make sure if I have food, I will feel it's wrong unless others in this world are fed. If I have a home, something will bother me because I know that others are homeless this evening. Just a small increase, I believe, in human empathy would work great benefit in society and a moderate slimming down of our need to consume would also allow the economy to find a greater stasis and balance. So I'm not talking about eliminating, you know, turning us into some kind of goody-goody robots, anything like that. Small changes. But my joke is that, you know, if we could somehow rewire the desire for sex with the desire to do charity, you would find people going on places like Pornhub, for example, and looking at videos of cats being rescued from trees, because they would be somehow so driven to do good. If you got the same passion and same pleasure that you got, let's say, from sex, that you to feed the hungry, we would all be building soup kitchens. All we need to do is rewire somewhat within ourselves the what drives us to pleasure. Right now, the secret, I believe, is to use capitalism's focus on pleasure. We see right now that people throughout the population are willing to do things to themselves for pleasure because it makes them feel good, that are very bad for themselves. For example, taking illegal drugs like the opioid crisis, for example, or other people are willing to, on a rumor, inject themselves with Ozempic because they want to lose 20 pounds. People smoke cigarettes or drink to excess because it brings them pleasure. People will engage in dangerous or unprotected sexual practices because it brings them pleasure. People are motivated by pleasure. If you can actually manufacture substances, methods that will make people feel better about themselves, feel good. It doesn't have to be, I'm not talking about getting high and being in like some morphine-like state. It doesn't have to be like that. If you give things something that makes people feel good and actually makes them healthier, makes them good, you will have people lined up in order to do it. The rich, the powerful, even they want to feel good. If there was something that makes people suddenly feel at home and peaceful in life, and at the same time turns them into kinder, more gentle, more loving people, I think you've got a winning combination there, Matthew.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to say I'm hearing a lot of utopian thought in there. I think one of the challenges, and then maybe we can move on to talk about some of the other ideas in the book, is that while we have the multivariant world that we live in, and we have capitalism functioning as it does, and the drivers mm-hmm. of capitalism being exactly what they are, I think that any kind of technology of this sort always ends up serving, you know, multivariant purposes. So I think that in some highly functional societies, you may be able to introduce some of this as a means for promoting what you've been describing within that given context. But I think at the same time, you're going to have other countries using it for nefarious purposes to make people happy to kill, for example.
And I can't stop that.
I'm trying to
head that off. That's my worry.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah,
it is going to be misused.
No, I get that. But I think one thing that's problematic is not acknowledging that none of this can ever be ethically neutral. You know, if you talk about just a little bit of happiness, a little bit of niceness, yeah, I agree that on a good day, aiming for that is great. And maybe it would be interesting to think of this in a more enlightened society as like a temporary thing. So you drink the tea you mentioned, right? And for a week, mm-hmm. you feel more compassionate, more tolerant, more patient, right? More reflective, yeah? And then after a week, that mm-hmm. ends. But there's no, in a sense, negative payoff like there can be when you come down from drugs. And whether that's ever going to be possible, I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out. But I also think there's also an interesting challenge here related to what it means to transform the human mind, right? Which is something you will know quite a bit about. It tends to take time. And one of the consequences of quick fixes is there's always a payment to be made, right? Mm-hmm. Always, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's mm-hmm. Antibiotics or it's I don't know, cortisone. I mean, these do miraculous things, right, which transform our bodies and our emotional and psychological states. And there's always a price to pay. So I wonder what might end up being the price that we pay to manufacture, in a sense, these propositive emotions.
Let me say first, hopefully it will be something for the long term, not for a week. Right. I'm talking about lasting changes in individuals. Also, I want to take Elon Musk as an example. Very unhappy, very rich, very miserable seeming individual who apparently is taking ketamine, according to his own admission, in order to get past his own depression and other struggles. He's also trying experimental substances in order to feel better about himself. I'm telling you that someone like Elon Musk, if you truly had a substance that worked, that made him feel better, and suddenly he's more loving and more generous and more caring towards others, he wouldn't be exactly the person that we're witnessing in the, right now. It would be, shall we say, the nice Elon. So I think that even the rich, the powerful, the leaders, my joke is that even if Putin suddenly did this and became empathetic and couldn't see someone injured, well, there's the end of the war in Ukraine. It would be impossible for the psychopath to truly engage in violence towards others if they had the proper degree of empathy. Now, is it a simple solution? Is it even possible? I don't know. I'm saying that, you know, Buddhism for thousands of years has worked on maybes and could-bes and hopes that our practices will free individuals. And I'm talking about maybe another pipe dream. But I'm saying, Matthew, that now is the time for our researchers, our scientists, some of them Buddhists, some of them not, to see, is there a possibility to actually develop things like this? And let's start working on it. What do we have to lose? If we do nothing, then the wars continue, the climate continues to degrade, violence in our streets, our children continue to suffer in this world in poverty and homelessness. What do we have to lose?
So, yeah, there's quite a bit of utilitarianism in there. And maybe Peter Singer, I don't know if you know much about him, would be on board with
these very ideas. Much, yes.
And he's probably already given it some thought. Yeah, I find them interesting as thought experiments, and I think that certainly the nearest possible outcome, based on what you've been saying so far, meaning what might come first, is certainly some technology or practices, or even, let's say, digital technology or implant that can shift moods. I can see that happening, and I can see that happening relatively soon. That wouldn't surprise me at all. I think in terms of long-term change and, let's say, more desirous images of the massive transformation of society, perhaps, right? Perhaps. Who knows? Why not? Let's have a look at what else you've been writing about in your book, though, Jundo, because otherwise we'll only manage to talk about these three. So let me just read some of the titles of the chapters, and then you can jump at the one which you think you'd like to talk about next. So we've got A Buddha by Design, Nirmanakaya, the Human Buddha, Biomedicine for the Three Poisons, which I think is what we were mostly talking about just now. Jizo Empties and Prisons, Upaya Uploads, Tech Mediant Means, Dharmakaya, the Universal Buddha, Simul, this, I quite like this one, Simulgakaya Buddha, Datakaya Buddha, and then moving onward towards Buddhanomics and Zen at the End of Time. So which one would you like to spend the next few minutes discussing?
Well, we've already spoken about possible ways, maybe even pipe dreams, in order to deal with suffering in the world, the poverty, the violence, the war. So let's talk about what future technology may offer for approaching true dukkha. I believe that I'm a Soto Zen Buddhist priest. The experience of dropping self is something that is very real and takes a lot of practice to work on through meditation. We do Zazen. And when you have that experience, I find it is something that is very relevant to the kind of suffering that arises from our being a separate self. You're Buddhist. You understand this. The sense of separate self in a world of other separate selves leads to friction, leads to disappointment and conflict, fears for tomorrow, disappointments at what happened yesterday because of the world of separation we live in. In the area of Buddhism where I practice, Soto Zen, we keep living in this world. We have to live in a world where there's you, where there's me, where sometimes I don't like what you've done. I don't like the way the world is. I don't like it's raining on my picnic today. I don't like to be sick when I want to be healthy. This is the world we live in. But at the same time, we can have this experience where the separate self is transcended. There is no separate you. There is no separate me. There's a sense that nothing is lacking. I like that we call it sometimes emptiness, but it just means emptiness of the separate self. And what exists at that point is a kind of wholeness, maybe a flowing wholeness. It's not something you can nail down. But in that wholeness, there is nothing lacking. Even death, because our separate self seems to come and go, even in the wholeness of that lack of separation, we can say that when we identify with the wholeness, nothing truly is born, nothing truly dies, because we are just that wholeness that's flowing. And even in the more radical sense, I like to say, through meditation in the traditional way, you can have the experience that we are just facets of each other. For example, Matthew is just Jundo's face in Italy, and I'm Matthew's face over here in Japan, and the bird is the fish flying in the sky, and the fish is the bird swimming in the sea. We get a sense that everything is each other in other guise. Such a feeling of wholeness it is. And that is a vital aspect of Buddhist practice for thousands of years. And it's very difficult to attain. Well, in the future, with new technologies, and even these days, I think, using sometimes substances, sometimes technical means, people can have such experiences in which the separate self is transcended. But important footnote there, not a footnote at all, important warning. Having the experience has always been just part of the practice, because then we have to get back into life and think how this relates to our world of separation. We're still living in a world where Matthew is not Jundo and Jundo is not Matthew, and I stub my foot on the table and the rain falls on my picnic, and I get sick when I don't want to, and yes, people are born and people die. We still have this experience, but through the technology and medicine that is coming, it will be easier to transcend the individual self.
And what kind of technology do you see enabling that process?
Well, already, the trouble is a lot of this is not controllable, and Buddhism is truly a lifetime practice. Taking a pill and having some kind of mystical trip or experience will not do it. It is Buddhism, as you know, is a practice that must continue day in and day out, and you integrate this into your life. But already, if you do take certain substances, such as, the people who take mushrooms have incredible mystical experiences. Applying electrodes to certain areas of the brain will cause the sense of separate self to dissolve, or more readily feel as if it softens. If you do these things, you can, shall we say, have a kind of shortcut to these experiences. But again, these experiences are not the destination. The experiences are just an important reference, vital on the path of transcending the separate self, but then we must get on with life and continue in this world. But in other words, instead of crossing the legs and staring at a wall for year in, year out, in order to have such experiences, it's going to become easier to do it at the push of a button, I think.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that specific perspective on the development of technology for a while, and that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. I mean, I'm more curious about the immediate consequences of all these things than in any idea of radically transforming society. Obviously, if that became possible, I'd be happy about it, I think, because the dysfunction around us is self-evident. And I mean, I appreciate the fact that you emphasize just how long Buddhism's been around and how long it's been pushing this Mahayana desire to save all beings from suffering and ignorance, and here we still are. So, you know, trying something else out might not be such a bad idea.
Not rejecting the path, not rejecting the past practices at all. Bringing it all together.
Yeah, you know? No, I get that.
The past practices are beautiful. Let's keep them. Yeah. But we'll just add to our repertoire.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting, I think, as well. Just the consequences. That's what fascinates me the most, because I think that prioritizing, I mean, obviously you're a Zen priest, so this is perhaps not the way you'll think about it. But for me, prioritizing even the, let's say, the dissolution of the illusion of the separate self is just a piece of a human existence. It's not some massive end goal that will somehow solve things or end them. I mean, you know, there are plenty of books which speak to that observation. Jack Kornfield's probably the most famous book, the one about, you know, after enlightenment, the laundry, something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that observation is sometimes played down by the pursuit of some kind of goal within meditation practice. So that's again another site of tension, which we could probably spend quite some time talking about, but won't. I appreciate the optimism that you're expressing, Jundo.
Desperation, not optimism. Desperation, Matthew. We have to fix this world.
Yeah, well, you seem to have converted some of that desperation into optimism, which I salute. I'm for that. I don't think we get anywhere with something like desperation. And I just want to say one you know, positive comment to add, because my reflections in response to what you're telling me are not explicit criticisms, right? They're more the kind of thought that gets inspired by your proposal. But there is a section in the book, for anyone that might be a bit worried, by John Cobb, who's an MD, in which he addresses actually some of the things that I raised in this conversation. Yeah. And I think that's a nice counterbalance to some of the hopeful strain that runs through the text as you've written it. We don't have a huge amount of time left, and we haven't really talked about robots or cyborg-like technology. Do you want to say anything about that? Have you given much thought to how that may develop and integrate?
Well, that's also coming. It's also very scary. It also presents many challenges and many new questions. The most obvious one is, first off, if AI were to develop sentience, you know, would you, do they have Buddha nature, as we Zen fellows would say? But even before that point, AI, I believe, needs to get the precepts into its programming. A little, shall we say, don't kill would be nice, and work for the benefit of sentient beings. A little selfish there, especially us human sentient beings. Whenever these programs are designed, they certainly should take to heart the idea that we leave this world better, not worse. And again, it's going to be a matter of the ethics that not only the programmers have in designing, but the AI, especially if we cannot regulate or anticipate if it has autonomous agency, it must also have a system of ethics. Now, I'm not the first one to say that. There are many, many people studying the ethics of AI, but I'm saying, specifically, the precepts should be there. Don't kill. A little honesty with us. Gentleness. Don't hate. These are important even into our programs. But I think AI will be a part of our life. Now, it presents, you know, there are many questions that Buddhism will face. What kind of Roshi will an AI be? I believe, for example, if AI starts handing out spiritual advice, it will be possible to program the AI to give you, Matthew, the spiritual advice that you want to hear. You know, if it was a psychiatrist, for example, and you it was an AI psychiatrist, and it would confirm you, and you continue your fun little habit of arson and bank robbery. You it will tell you whatever you wish, because you can design your own personal version of a spiritual guide or a counselor to confirm you in whoever you are. And even, you know, it's going to be in our relationships too. You'll have the spouse, the significant other who will always agree with you on all your opinions, will watch every movie you want to watch without any disagreement. It's going to be so hard to deal with flesh and blood human beings when we can have these ideal partners in life that do whatever we want. Well, the danger in Buddhism is that when you have these AI gurus and roshis, they need to get transmission. Now, I don't mean electrical transmission. I mean also Dharma transmission. We need to have human teachers who certify the reliability of our AI spiritual roshis. Otherwise, we will not know what they are spouting.
All right, that's pretty outrageous.
I'm telling you, within 5 years, it sounds crazy now. Within 5 years, you're going to see it's a real issue.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's crazy. I think, unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever, it is a high possibility. I'm glad you picked up on some of the negative sides of that, because the narcissism of our current culture would certainly beg for, hey, psychologist, tell me exactly what I want to hear. Please.
The beauty of the Imperfect Buddha podcast is you dealt with issues early on about cults in Buddhism, teachers who were misusing their power. You dealt with it in such an honest way. Well, it's going to be much the same when the technology is also taking advantage of us, or we're allowing it to take advantage of us. It also has to be kind of regulated ethically in a way, as much as a flesh and blood teacher needs to be regulated by the surrounding community to make sure that they're not abusing students. There are going to be so many spiritual products on the market that, well, we have to find some way to certify which are the good ones.
Yeah, I think multiplicity is one of the keys to all this, right? Because we are going to get all of it, from the most evil abuses and uses to the most benevolent. And perhaps part of what we can hope for is that enough of it settles somewhere in some sane middle and lean towards the good. But you know, we've got thousands of years of ethics struggling with even that question. So it's going to be interesting what kinds of minds and societies do end up programming this stuff. You know, when you talk about giving a precept to AI to do no harm or be kind, I mean, again, you could probably carry out an interesting thought experiment on where that could potentially go, because without sentience, of course, you know, AI is just zeros and ones working together along pre-programmed lines predetermined by humans. And what wasn't it, the most recent form of Gemini from Google, a form of experimental AI, had a kind of axiomatic input of be good and be racially just, and it just basically made everybody reappear from history with black skin, which is perhaps one of the first signs of how that good intentions can go wrong and actually create tension in society. But Junda, I think you've dared to experiment with imagining the great possibility of how technology could evolve society and man beyond his basest instincts. And I'm curious to see what actually takes place as imperfect humans get their hands on all this stuff. And I don't know how many years or decades I've got left, but I don't think I've got that many. So I guess you said you've got kids. Our kids are going to see more of this than we do, right?
Unfortunately or fortunately, that is so. And they're the ones, unless there's also a life extension section in the book too. So unless we do make it to 200, which is a small possibility, much more likely for my daughter, who's 13 right now. She may make it to 130, much more than you or me, Matthew. But unfortunately, my book is a silly book, and it's too early. I'm raising a lot of questions that maybe people will still think, oh, well, this is just science fiction. But I'm thinking that in 20 years, a lot of these issues I'm raising are going to be more matter of fact and really facing us. I truly believe the only way we can deal with global warming and our treatment of the environment, the only way we can truly regulate war in this world, the only way we can truly lessen poverty once and for all after so many millennia of human beings preaching about it and wishing for it and praying for it, sitting for it and reading old dusty books about it. The only way we can truly deal with what ails us as human beings, Marx couldn't do it. Jesus couldn't do it. The Buddha himself could not do it except for small numbers of people. The only way we can truly do it across large sectors of the population as we need to is changing human nature. We now have a chance. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, good. Yeah, and I think as technology develops, you're going to see a similar dynamic to the one we have now, which is some Buddhists of that time will use technology as a form of retreat from the world, and others will use it or use these technologies as methods for seeking to change the world in a way they see fit. And you know, I think you're navigating that line currently in this book is a statement towards the latter.
Unfortunately or fortunately, some Buddhists are going to just go into simulations where they don't have to deal with all these problems because they can create the pure land in their own minds, plug them in one end, put a diaper on the other one. You know, as long as the money keeps paying and the electricity stays on, you can spend your whole life, maybe whole lifetimes, in a simulation where your every desire, your every positive emotion you wish to feel, it will all be available to you. That maybe will be some people's choice. But I believe this world is kind of also our mind creation in large degree. But it's also up to us to what we do with it. And I think we can do a lot better. And I think we should keep our mind open that there may be new ways coming to do that.
Okay. Well, you heard it, folks. That's Jundo Cohen.
A dreamer.
Building the Future Buddha. a dreamer. Okay, let's say Jundo Dreamer Cohen.
Right.
And the book is Building the Future Buddha. If you like this kind of thought and would like to read up a bit more on it, it's out now. Go for it. Get yourself a copy. Jundo, thanks for coming on and giving up some of your Zen time to speak with us here on the Imperfect Buddha podcast.
Thank you, Matthew, and I look forward to many, many future episodes where I'll be spending with you, listening for hours and hours.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad someone's tuning in and getting something useful out of all this. And thanks for your positive words with regards to the cult episodes. That seems like a lifetime ago already, but you're right. It was one of the great drivers that got us started in the first place. And so, yeah, thanks for that acknowledgement. Jundo, best of luck with your practice and with your future work in the future of the Buddha.
Thank you, Matthew.
Bye for now. This interruption serves to remind you of two things, and I'll keep it brief. Number one, this podcast now has a donation option on its website, imperfectbuddha.com. Think about it. How much do you listen to this podcast? Really? How much have you got out of it? If the answer is very little, then skip ahead. But if you're a regular listener who benefits from these kinds of interviews I hold and these kind of creative turns that I've been experimenting with, then you might want to give something back. And here's my thoughts on it. If you don't give something back to me, give something back to someone else. Perhaps to your favorite podcast. The other one, of course. Anyway, I think it's right that you do so. I do so myself. And it needs to happen, really, in this day and age. I know how much time and energy I put into all this. So, some of my favourite podcasts, well, they're doing exactly the same thing. And apart from those on the BBC or that belong to other professional organisations, the lesser ones, like this one, are usually put together by hard-working, inspired individuals trying to share quality content. So, give something back today, folks. Give something back. Secondly, well, as you should know by now, this podcast is sponsored by O'Connell Coaching. That's my coaching business. And if you don't know the spiel, I'll quickly give it to you in 1 minute max. I offer coaching, support, mentoring, and guidance to those taking, well, a different kind of approach to spirituality and Buddhism.
waking up, coming to know your mind, dealing with your emotions, etc., etc. Any of the themes we've tackled on the podcast can be faced in a one-to-one coaching dynamic. Many people find it useful. I've been refining and tailoring my approach over the last few years. I'm finding it more rewarding too, and it seems that other folks are too. Three options: coaching, Buddhist style practice and engagement, and the shamanic stuff that, well, a lot of people seem to be rather curious about, to the point that I might actually have a podcast episode on that topic soon, but shan't give away my secrets right now. The kind of information for O'Connell Coaching is now being placed all together at the same website, imperfectbuddha.com. Get in touch if you feel the need.